I love scotch.
Yep. Scotch. Have another whiskey.
If you'd like to speak to me in person, press 1. If you'd like to order drugs, press hash.
I had a gentleman in the crowd that was like, tell me how to drink Glenfiddich. And I was like, I will not do that.
Yep.
You drink Glenfiddich how you want to drink Glenfiddich.
Wear a cowboy hat in Los Angeles and look at the amount of looks you get.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. This is the most flamboyant city on earth. You wear a cowboy hat, people look at you like you are like an alien.
The Beatles came on and they picked me up on his shoulder. George Harrison is as close to me as that wall now. I went, all right, George, all right. And he went, cough. And that was the closest I ever came to the Beatles.
We have a whiskey while we...
Yeah, let's do it again.
Yeah.
Cheers, long.
Cheers. Welcome back to United States of Dramerica. And this is an episode that has been probably about 18 months in the planning. So I am very excited to have on one of Scotland's top tennis players, played at Wimbledon twice, former world number 167 in doubles, friend of the Murrays, whiskey drinker, real Scot. Welcome to the podcast, Nicola Slater.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
So this is great. We met in, I think, the most British way, which was, and obviously you have to remember that there was a time before the pandemic when people used to fly regularly. And we were sitting at an airport, at Salt Lake City Airport, as the delay boards came up for the flights to the UK.
And, oh, that's right.
And they, you know, they came out an announcement saying there's a delay of this amount of time and another amount of time. And like good British people, we sort of turned to each other. We've never met. We're just sitting there and turned to each other and go, that's bloody flights delayed. This is very annoying. And we sort of moaned about it. And we would have moaned about the weather probably, but we moaned about the flight. And
we moaned about the pilot not preparing for the weather and getting stuck at his bloody house. Who lives in Salt Lake City and gets snowed in?
Exactly, that's right. It was, so we did actually, the weather brought us together like it often does for British people, and we eventually got the flights.
Pretty sure we clapped when the pilot showed up British ways.
I think we did. And then we stayed in touch and we were planning to do a podcast, and then there was a global pandemic, and then ridiculously you kept giving up drinking every time I suggested dates for the podcast. But here we are. So
I'm back on the bottle.
let's just get straight into some whiskey drinking before we do some questioning. So what have you got at your end, Nicola?
I have the Balvenie Double Wood, aged 12 years.
Very good. So I was thinking to myself, as always, I try and pair my whiskey with my guest. So do I have a whiskey related to where you're from? You're from Ayr? You know, do I get a whiskey from around there? Do I get a whiskey from the somewhere near the green part of Glasgow because you are a Celtic fan? And I thought, no, I'll do a tennis-themed whiskey. So I was going to do a ridiculous cocktail where I have whiskey with some juice. Obviously, I'm not going to put juice in whiskey. So I thought, you know what I'd do? I'm going to have a whiskey that's either 0 years old, 15 years old, 30 years old, or 40 years old.
Now, love it.
I don't have any 40-year-old whiskey. I've got one bottle of 15. I've got a Balvenie 15, but I've also got a bottle of 30-year-old, which I have not opened yet. Not Balvenie 30, unfortunately.
Okay.
I've got a bottle of Alexander Murray Monumental 30-year-old blend, which I have not opened, and I'm now going to open. So
I'm actually quite jealous because I like Alexander Murray, because that's the one... The first time I actually finally got back into drinking whiskey, because everyone always thought I would like whiskey being Scottish. And at tennis tournaments, when I was getting hosted by one orthopedic surgeon who had some of the most expensive whiskey I've probably ever drank, I had to force that down politely in my very British ways and act like I liked it. But the first whiskey that got me back to liking whiskey was actually Alexander Murray, but it's sold in Costco, right? So it was the 20-year-old double sherry cask one.
Fantastic.
And I love my Alexander Murray now because of that one.
Amazing. So we had the guy who founded Alexander Murray on the podcast a few episodes ago. He's a friend of mine, and I have lots of Alexander Murray, and I give bottles of whiskey to people as gifts, and I often give Alexander Murray. And I've found myself in possession of this 30-year-old, and I need an
brilliant experience.
And tennis, where 30 is an important number, Wow, this is amazing. Anyway, cheers, Nicola. It's been a long time.
Got my Celtic link, Karen, just for you.
Celtic, they're very good. So let's just go straight into this. You played at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
Now, I've played on the courts at Wimbledon. Like a week after they finished, my mate got me on and I played like doubles.
That's a lot better than most people, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's hard to get on. So like playing on court 7 2 weeks after Wimbledon about 15 years ago was the highlight of my not very good at tennis career. But what's it like as a British person to play at Wimbledon twice?
It's funny because obviously everyone grows up wanting to, you know, that's, I'm sure for an American, it's the US Open. For a Brit, it's always seeing Wimbledon, wanting to do that. And you're warned and you see the pressure that they put on the likes of Tim Hemman, Greg Radetzky, and then obviously Andy. And a lot of the players talk about how they hate the grass season because of the pressure and the press and everything else that goes along with playing at Wimbledon and being British. It's funny, I kind of like the pressure a little bit, but what I enjoyed too was I felt like I was kind of under the radar a little bit because I was a doubles player, wasn't really known, so I thought it would be a little bit easier. And you know, obviously it's the highlight and it's the dream, and it was amazing to have my family and friends be able to come and watch, and everything was great and I was ready to go and loving it and the traditions and finally feeling proud of where I'd gotten to and all the rest. And the day of the match was when I truly understood what it felt like to be British playing at Wimbledon. Warm up, fine. Sit down, gather our thoughts. We get going. I literally couldn't breathe for that whole first game just because, you know, people are watching you. You're British. It's the first time. I'm sure just like anyone or a junior playing in a final, you kind of expect those nerves and you expect people to struggle, or any, not even juniors, just tennis players in general. The one that has experience is usually the one you're going to put your money on. But that whole first game, and it wasn't until we won that first game and I felt, okay, thank God we're not going to lose this, love and love, or make fools of ourselves. I felt myself breathe and was like, oh my gosh, I was completely not breathing that whole entire game. And from then on, you get finally settled, and it was an unreal experience. But yeah, being British at Wimbledon for the first time ever, now I understand. And I understand seeing, because I couldn't understand some of my other friends that would, you know, start to stress out or get really, really nervous even in the lead up and kind of act very out of the ordinary, very uptight. And now I kind of get it, because there is a lens on you massively.
So which court did you play on?
Funnily, when you said 7, I was like, oh, so close to mine, 5.
And in 2015, same or?
I can't remember on that one. Where was that?
Can you not remember? You've played at Wimbledon twice and you can't remember the court.
And it, well, I know as well, years ago, I was one of the very lucky ones that my first ever coach, Jan Collins, his grandfather played, and he's a member of the All England Club, unreal. He just won the Lifetime Achievement Award for Tennis Scotland. And so three of us had to drive in a car down to Solihull. And as kids, we were quite disappointed because all the other kids were on the train. And so we thought we're getting the bum deal driving with the old coach, until he made a pit stop and we got to play at Wimbledon. So there were a couple of times, and now those kind of mesh in with the numbers. So I know it was a higher number, but it meshes in with the times I was there. So I know I've played on 12, 15, and I think 17. But that was, I mean, that was my first time playing on the grass back then, was when I was like 13 years old. And kind of like you, it would have been after the championships and everything else. But yeah, to play there with a crowd, different experience.
Playing at Wimbledon, even though you didn't win, is that the highlight of your career more than actually winning tournaments elsewhere?
Yes, I'm just bitterly disappointed. I lost in 3 sets both times and to very good players as well. I mean, I lost to Cornet and Parmentier. The Elise Cornet is, she's up there in the singles now as well with the French player. And they were a consistent partnership. Lisa Wyburn, my partner, it was our, you know, we'd only played a couple of tournaments together. So we did really, really well considering. So I'm still bummed about that. And then the second time was against Petra Martic and Johanna Larsson. Martic is still playing, quarterfinal of I don't know how many Grand Slams. Larsson, semi-finalist of Australian Open. So, you know, our draws were tough, but that's what's the killer is we were right there. So I know we had the level. It would have been so much better to say I won there, but it is. I'm just happy I got to play, but definitely the highlight. I mean, I've got some good titles, but yeah, that takes the cake.
Now, as you'd expect from a professional tennis player from Scotland of your age, you know the Murrays. Did you obviously, Andy played slightly more games than you at Wimbledon.
Just a few.
And Jamie. But did you ever talk to them about all of that stuff, the nerves and so on, from their maybe from their earlier appearances?
No, it was more so Judy that I spoke to, just because, you know, she was my coach and she understood my temperament as well. Although I'm very much, I was, my family, everyone jokes about it. Judy says I am the female version of Andy. It's actually scary how very alike we are. So my temperament was very much like his, although he obviously got way better at keeping his composure, although he still yells at his box, which again, I understand. I'm animated on court. And so she was definitely the one that helped me, because I even said there were times right before it to try and get sponsorships and endorsements and kind of get my name out there. She set up some media things, which of course is important and I was always grateful for. But like I said earlier, I kind of liked flying under the radar a little bit. So I was like, you know, do I really want to do this? It was important though, in order to keep playing, I needed sponsorship. So, and that's where she was like, I know you like being under the radar, but you kind of have to come out in the spotlight a little bit. I just felt for my first year, it would be nice to kind of, and then make a splash and then I would be in the spotlight, right? That's kind of, I wanted that underdog story because I always was the underdog. But I definitely, yeah, I spoke to her about it. And it's funny, the only person I could see in the crowd often was actually Judy. Even on match point, when I'm the one that was on top of the net and missed the volley by probably an inch, and my heart sank and I almost wanted to burst into tears. First person I looked on the side of the court was Judy. But no, I mean, like I said, I didn't have massive nerves. I wasn't really, she obviously helped. And then I had a mentor, Sarah Borwell, who's a British doubles player as well. And she was helping me out at the time. So I have them to thank. They kind of kept me grounded, gave me the advice, give your phone to a friend, don't look at your phone, don't deal with the people asking you your times, just focus on your tennis. So I had a good support group around me that kind of helped me with all that stuff. So I didn't need to bother Jamie and Andy too much.
You started playing tennis because they wouldn't let you play football, is that right?
Yeah, well, it wasn't that they would let me play, but back then, and it blows my mind because football is so big now, and even in Scotland, there's way more girls playing, but in Ayr, there were no clubs that had girls. I mean, they had girls, but they weren't allowed, there were no teams. And same in my primary school team, and that's when the boys tried to petition for me, is because I played every interval and every lunch with them, and I was goalkeeper. I was the only person that was willing to dive. I don't know if you remember back at school, there was no grass. It was just pure dirt and concrete that you were diving on. I was the only one that was diving on that to save the ball. So the boys were happy with me being on the team, and they petitioned, and the coach said, yeah, I mean, we can have you in practice, but you can't play in the games. It's just girls aren't allowed. And ironically, as it always is, they allowed them when I moved up to secondary school. And then secondary, it was the same battle. There were no girls and there were no teams. And it was right when my mum and dad finally found a club in Ayr that had a girls team, the one team in the whole of Ayrshire or South Ayrshire. And primary teacher said, oh no, put her into a racquetball sport. And they were like, well, we don't know how to do that. How's that going to happen? And, you know, she loves football. I was a football lover. I was kicked a ball since I was 1 year old. Like that was my first love. And they found out about a little after school club that I could go learn tennis, and it just snowballed. I was a little miffed in the beginning though. And miffed for those listening, obviously not happy. I was very miffed in the beginning because I didn't like tennis in the beginning because it was taking away from my time with football. I wanted to be a football player. But yeah, I wonder how, and now I still look back because I left the country obviously and tennis took over. I wonder how it grew all of a sudden, because I feel like girls' soccer here, as they say, in football, has grown massively.
It really has. I mean, I think there's been a lot of debates. I don't know if it's because I've been at home more and been watching the news more, or just, you know, social justice more broadly, people's behaviour more broadly has been under the spotlight. But see, there's the big court case in American soccer about should the women be paid more than the men.
Yeah.
I think this is the only place you could really have that debate because the women's team. And so it makes sense that they lead that charge. But in women's tennis, there's been lots of talk for years about whether there should be equal pay in the tournaments. And there's one side of arguments about the number of sets being played and is that fair? And there's various other ones. Where do you sit on all of this? And also, like, how quickly is everything changing from what, as you see it?
Well, ironically, you know, it says a lot for me. The whole reason why prize money is equal at Grand Slams is I'll be the first to say, and, you know, I'll put it out there, and I'm happy for it. It's actually the men that kind of did it. It was Andy and Federer that fought for that. So to me, it says a lot if the guys are fighting for that too, right? It would be one thing if it was just the women fighting, but the fact that the men are standing up for them too, there's obviously something to be said, and that makes a big statement. For me as a player, though, I get it. I understand why the men are angry, because they're playing the best of five sets, but that's only in the Grand Slams. The rest of the year, they're playing the best of three, just like us. And I know you can put it down to TV ratings and entertainment, but I'm pretty sure they showed at one point that the Serena and Venus doubles match, that's the other thing too, doubles isn't covered either. I'm sorry, but that's what the biggest sport like that in tennis that is played in anywhere, actually, even in the UK, it's all doubles. It's just not broadcasted. There was a bigger draw in spectators at the US Open Live and on TV when they had Venus and Serena playing in doubles than they did for a quarterfinal men's singles match. So I think it all depends. It's all about marketing, right? And who's out there and the names. So that I know some of the male players say, oh, well, yeah, you're not drawing tickets. Well, that depends again on the marketing, and it depends on the player. But I say the women work just as hard off the court and in their training. There's no difference in the training. They do the same training. They do the same tournaments for the rest of the year. So why not be paid equally? I mean, was it not Serena Williams and the chance of her getting her 21st Grand Slam that the minute people found out it could happen, they sold out immediately? That was the first final to sell out, was the women's final at the US Open. It wasn't the men's and everything else. So again, I think I understand why some players say, you know, I think, I'm trying to remember, was it Nadal that caused the stir when he said that, or Thiem, or someone? It might even have been Tommy Haas, when he was like, oh, well, we're not watching these female players, it's the males. Well, that's fine when you're talking and you're comparing yourself to one of those like other females that aren't known. But do you have that same argument if you're going up against Serena Williams? People are going to pay to see her more than they will to see him. So I'm kind of on the agreement of pay is all the same. Okay, the Grand Slams, I'd actually be okay with the men getting more if they play more. But women have also agreed, we were willing to play the best of five sets if that's what it took. But that then comes down to the federations and the bodies, the WTA, ATP, saying people aren't going to tune in for that long. And I agree. I barely can watch a five-set match between men. I tune in, watch the beginning, go do stuff, and I come back when it's like near the end of the match. Kind of like a basketball game. I wait till the last minute because the last minute takes a whole hour with all the timeouts and everything else. So it's, you know, a five-set match is actually a lot. And I think that they're having talks on seeing how can they make this more spectator-friendly, because it is long and it is a lot, and scheduling and everything else for players. So I'm on the stance of women, at least from my personal experience, I bust my backside. I work just as hard. You know, they work just as hard. They do the same kind of training. Everything's the same. So why not be paid the same? So I kind of agree with it. And then the fact that the men are fighting on our behalf as well, I think that says a lot too, and only grateful to them as well, because without their voices, I'm sure it would be much harder.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I you know, I think Andy Murray particularly has been very good at that sort of thing. What's interesting is over the last year, obviously lots of people have behaved badly during the pandemic. And in our pre-match, we were discussing that, particularly in America, there's been lots of poor behaviour related to mask wearing and behaviours that have made the pandemic possibly worse. But tennis, maybe more than some other sports, hasn't done brilliantly in the sense of, you know, Djokovic invited a whole load of people together in April or May who all got coronavirus. And then some of the whinging around the Australian Open when, you know, this was a point where the time of year, California hospitals were literally full. Like ambulances were doing 8-hour waits to drop off and people were complaining about being stuck in hotels. Given that I know professional sport, particularly on the tennis circuit, unless you're the top handful, is a tough life, but have your former colleagues behaved well in relation to the pandemic, would you say?
Ironically, my former colleagues, yes, because a lot of them are playing, they're struggling because there aren't enough tournaments for them. You know, there's nothing going on and they're in the lower level. So it's like the ITF and they're playing in the, and the problem is there's WTA players because there are no tournaments right now. There are unseen rankings, top 100 players playing in these tournaments that would never dream of playing in a 25 or a 50K. So I've actually seen the lower level players be way more appreciative of anything that comes their way. And they're the ones that need it, which is why that tour that I get what Djokovic was trying to do, but at the end of the day, and I know he's stepped up and he's trying to help the lower level players, but that tournament was all the top players. Again, appearance money to the people who already get paid a ton. And then same with the Australian Open. I think the whinging, if you look at it, really only came from the more privileged players. You know, the ones who were just happy barely getting into the tournament. I mean, I'm sure they would have sat in there for a month if they had to. And to me, it kind of, it's interesting. And I wonder if it was out of fear too. It kind of leveled the playing fields a little bit. Because I actually even said this right when the pandemic happened and pre-pandemic, I said this. I was like, I would love to see these top players and see if they're as successful without the crowds, without, you know, the team around them. Are they able to go to these places in the middle of nowhere and show up and compete? Like Dan Evans, I don't know if you saw any of the UK Pro Series Tour, whatever the what was made, the Battle of the Brits and everything else. People were stunned at how he could fist pump and have that energy when there's no one around. I'm very much like that. I'm very much like that too. Like I'm that competitive and I just love the sport. But I've always said there's a lot of players up there that rely on their coaches and everything else to pump them up and give them that energy and the fans and everything else. So I was intrigued and I wonder if that's what some of the tantrums were about was, you know, I'm stuck in my hotel room for 2 weeks. Now, obviously it's evened out a little bit. I mean, I get it. They were worried about injury and everything else. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're lucky to be playing in a tournament. There were a lot of people still in lockdown and not able to do anything. And to be able to sit in a hotel room for 2 weeks, still get prize money and then live a normal life. I mean, I'm sure there were players in the ITF circuit that would, like I said, they would have sat there for longer and for a lot less.
Yeah.
So I think it was a bit ridiculous. And it's the colleagues. It's funny. It's the colleagues that are in that lower level that have been very good about it. And it's the, and are having to deal with Tara Moore, my doubles partner, the second time at Wimbledon. She Snapchatted me. She was at an ITF at Newport Beach and they have to wear masks and they get tested daily, right? It's a pro level tournament. And there's all these kids around, no masks, no nothing. And it's kind of like, you wouldn't see that with the WTA. Here they are getting their bubbles, making sure it's all perfect. And, you know, they're complaining. And it's like, it's just, the gap is insane. And I thought the coronavirus and the pandemic would help close it. And I think a lot of people were hopeful of that. I knew it would take a lot. And sadly, it's not. It's not happened.
I've always been obsessed with the rung of sport below the top. So, you know, I was a sports journalist for a few years and my favourite stories were, you know, the world's number 31 squash player. And, you know, I remember when I was in Bermuda doing a story with somebody who was ranked, I think, 126 at tennis, which is obviously very, very good. But no yeah. one, like literally no one who doesn't follow tennis will have heard of 126. And they're on that cusp where they might make the Grand Slam if they qualify, they might not. But it's the whole, like, you know, playing in the Vietnam Open and tanking a game because the flight's too expensive if you win compared to the prize money and all this sort of stuff. And I had a golfer on here who's trying to get onto the second tier tour. And he was talking about like driving through the night to get to tournaments and all this sort of stuff. Like that level of sport is fascinating. The private jets at the top is so rarefied, but
very
playing, obviously ranked, you know, 167 in the world bubbles is a serious thing, but it's, you know, you're way off lots of people's radar and five-star hotels and private jets and so on. What was it like when you were going to some of those far-flung places and presumably, you know, sharing hotel rooms with more of you than probably you would want and all that stuff? Like, what was that?
Sleeping in your clothes because you don't want to sleep in the $10 Mexican hotel sheets and everything else. Yeah.
Tell me about some of that stuff.
I mean, I wanted to write a book, I think, and I almost started during the pandemic. I actually almost started a podcast, and it's a shame. There's so many players that are so scared to share their stories, but it's where all this stuff, like, if you heard the stories, if you were to read this book or hear this podcast, if I'd been able to do it, you wouldn't believe it because you're like, no way, the professional like tennis player in the tour, there's no way this happens. And like you said, they're not far off. If I put someone who even knows tennis, someone who knows tennis and knows good tennis and knows the top players, if I put a player that's even 300 in the world and then a top player, like a top 50 player, and have them play a match, that tennis person or player or club player would not know the difference. It's very rare they'd be able to tell the difference between the rankings. And that's how close it is. And that's how much it separates. It's not a lot. It's sometimes dumb luck, sponsorship, support, all, it's always about support, right? But I say that's that lower level, and that's where all the stuff, the fun stuff happens, the crazy stuff happens. I mean, like I said, the I remember Mexico, all of us legitimately, I think, like you said, there are way too many bodies for this one room. We're each paying literally $10 a night, but we all slept in our clothes and would not sleep on top of the covers. Under the covers, we'd sleep on top. And I mean, I saw players recently, same thing with the pandemic. Now that there's even less, they're having to fight even harder. And same thing, they're driving through the night, or, you know, taking a 24-hour trip with five different layovers, a bus trip, and everything else. I always go back to Mexico because I was 22, young and dumb, and thank God I was ignorant. I mean, I had to change from Coatzacoalcos, and I had to make it to, I think it was Irapuato, and I had to get on a bus through the night, and it stopped in Mexico City. So I left at 3 a.m. in the morning alone on this bus, blonde hair, blue eyed, big travel bag, racket bag, got to Mexico City, had to sit at the bus terminal for another 3 hours until I could get the second bus. I know Mexican people that will not sit in the Mexico City bus station for 10 minutes themselves, let alone, and I don't know how I didn't get robbed or how stuff didn't happen to me. I kind of look back on the stuff that I did and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I put myself in the, now being older and wiser, the danger that I did. But it's what you got to do. It's just, it's, you love the sport, and I mean, you're not playing in the most exotic places, right? It's places like, I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard, I love the town. I'm going to say that first. The people were amazing. But Landisville, Pennsylvania, ever heard of it? It's not like you're playing in these amazing, I remember looking up at Landisville, Pennsylvania, into the hills and the fields and the cows. It's Amish land. And being like, what am I doing here? Like, what am I doing? And I was winning the match and just started crying. Just because it takes a toll. It definitely takes a toll. But I definitely have some interesting stories, and I think I'm still tempted to do a book or hopefully get some players brave enough to share some of their crazy stories. One of the craziest ones I think I heard was a colleague getting locked out of her host family's house and having to sleep on the ground for the entire night before a match because they thought when she went to the player party, which, let's get this out there, a player party is when you thank the sponsors and you sit and have a dinner and you thank the host families and you make an appearance for those people to meet you. It's not a party. We're not drinking. We're not, you know, getting turned up or whatever it is and dancing. It's a nice meal to say thank you to everyone. They locked her out of the house because she thought she'd gone to party.
Amazing. It's a fascinating world. I guess it's tricky because at what point did you decide? Because I know at one point you were coaching while playing.
You know, always.
you were funding your continuing career through coaching. You know, obviously you could have given up earlier. Once you knew you weren't going to be the world number one, you could have given up earlier, or you could have kept going for longer. Like, how did you make the decision about when to call time on it?
Well, it's exactly what I was just saying. I have been doing, not really like everyone else, but I'd been doing this a long time, meaning the fighting and the grind and the underdog. I started late. I was told I couldn't even be a part of the Scotland squad when I first started. And it was Judy again that fought for me and said, no, give her a chance. She'll catch up. She's talented. I think Judy liked me, and she very much, like herself, is not an in-the-box type of person. And I was very much an outside of the box. So she supported me always. And I've always been fighting and everything else and been okay with doing that on my own. As a Scot, had a bit of a chip on my shoulder for everyone else who got help and funding that never even made it past 18 years old. But now realize looking back that it was a blessing because it's what taught me to fight. And maybe I would have given up if I would been given the support that they were given and whatever else. But it turned into, I finally, in late 2012, it was actually Sarah Barwell, like I mentioned earlier, who was mentoring me. And she said, you know, you got to quit this coaching thing. You can't do it. You can't put everything into your tennis if you're working 10 hours on court to try and fund this. You need to sell everything you own, get out of the place you're living in, get out of the lease and live out your bag and put your chips and go all in. And ironically enough, that's when I went from 872 in the world to 167 in the space of 5 months. And then injury kind of plagued me when I started back with Tara. I was finally getting into a good place mentally, physically, was climbing up again. And that's why I swore I would never have regret, but I do have regret. I retired definitely 1 year too early. And there's still times now, if it weren't for the pandemic, I would have gone back out on the road. If I had the support and I was able to bring people I love with me on the road, I would have gone back out and played. I would even now, probably, if I was offered that kind of support, I would do it. I don't doubt my ability. And now I have a bit more of that life experience and being able, having that hindsight. But when I called it quits, it was literally because I had started realizing that the traveling alone was just, I was being in places like Italy, where it's my mom and my sister's favorite country, and thinking, oh, I wish they were here. It's asking a stranger at Niagara Falls to take a picture of you. Same in Istanbul, asking a stranger to take a picture, and the next day at the airport, someone tells you, oh, I know you. And I'm like, oh, I'm about to get robbed or something here. This is a scam. Like, they're luring me in for something. And she was like, no, I know you. And I was like, how do you know me? And she's like, I took a picture of you with my boyfriend. You asked my boyfriend and I to take a picture of you outside the Blue Mosque yesterday. I was like, oh my gosh, that is you. And so I was just realizing maybe there's more to life, and I wanted to settle down and kind of I've been alone. I moved to America in 2003. My family now live in Australia since 2009. I've never really had a support system. And I wanted to have that. And I wanted to go to places that I wanted to go visit, not end up in countries that I would try to make the most of just because I was there. So that's why I stopped, is I made that decision, and it had nothing to do with realizing, funnily enough, that I didn't think, oh, I'm never going to get there. I still have full faith in my ability and my talent, actually more now probably because I have that perspective and don't have the same pressures anymore and could probably play a bit more freely and understanding that there is more to life, because tennis was my everything then and it was life or death essentially for me. Andy Murray says in his documentary that when people say, oh, it's just tennis, I was like, oh my gosh, that's how I feel. People would tell me it's just tennis, and it's not. It's more than just tennis. But now I kind of, I get that a little bit more. It still is more than just tennis, I will say that. It still is life, but that's why I stopped. I just got tired of being on the road alone and having zero support system, as in not just tennis, just in life in general, like friends, everything else, they were always a phone call, but it's not the same. Yeah. So just got, yeah, in a hotel room, hadn't even started the tournament yet, and you're crying. That's not a good start to the tournament.
No, I feel like it's probably a sign you should reassess your priorities.
Yes, and that's what I did, but I definitely lived with a little bit of regret. I think I was on the rise, and I think if I'd, well, again, it's, there's always what ifs. Who knows if I would have been able to have those that I needed around me be able to travel with me. It's not an ideal world. We don't all have a physio and a coach and, you know, a manager to travel with that can keep your spirits high.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to try and compare what I did with what you did, but I remember when I was a sports journalist, it sounded great. Like my friends who like sport, like, wow, it's amazing. You're going to all these things. And I'd fly, you know, I flew to Namibia to cover a cricket tournament. And I covered tennis tournaments. I interviewed famous people and it was all very exciting. But it doesn't quite work if you don't have other. And at the beginning, when you're very young, this is like, it's all adventures and it's all excitement. But actually, you know, there was a point I realized, actually the point when I met the person who's now my wife, when she had a normal 9-to-5 job and I worked every weekend and a lot of evenings, you're like, well, yeah, you know, watching this sport on my own, obviously it's not the same as playing, but watching this sport traveling around on my own, it's not the same. There's a point where you realize it's not what you thought it was. And then that's when you have to make different decisions about what you want to do with things.
Yeah. You want to, and that's, I feel like as you get older, you want to share things with people. And that's what I started doing. Like I would say, I would never, and I would tell anyone, never give up your dream for a girl or a boy or whatever. I've always said that. And I certainly, I don't want my spouse to ever think that I quit tennis just for that. And I didn't, but it certainly weighed in, right? Kind of like what you said, I started seeing, you know what, maybe there is a bit more to this. I was already feeling it. And then it kind of just got accelerated more by the fact that I'd been dating and my now spouse and everything else. So it was it definitely was a factor, but I was already feeling lonely. Like I said, I've been doing it for so many years, and like you said, everyone's like, oh, this is amazing, you travel the world. And I'm not gonna lie, it was the best job and I will always be grateful, and I never didn't appreciate it, but it is tougher than people think. You know, it seems glamorous, but it's not like you're getting to explore these places either. It was often hotel, tennis club, hotel, tennis club, hotel, airport. And that's the thing too. The minute you lose, you're gone, because there's a bill to be paid. And the longer you stay, the more expensive that bill got. So the minute you lose, you're gone. You move to the next place and you do what you can. So I certainly was grateful. And I think I know some players I've worked with, at least in juniors, who are super grateful and appreciative of everything they've done. They've struggled with the fact that they feel, you know, lonely and it's tough. And they have an internal battle because they're young, where they're like, you know, I should be feeling good about this. There's so many people that would trade this spot with me in a heartbeat. And here I am, homesick and wanting to go home. And I just felt terrible for the player. I was like, look, I know you appreciate the gift that you've been given and that you're able to do this. I said, but at the same time, you got to do what makes you happy. You can't. I appreciated the fact that a junior was able to weigh that up and be appreciative and understand that there were many people who would want to trade spots with them. But at the end of the day, and that's what I realized when I was playing, you got to be happy. Otherwise, how are you meant to perform?
Yeah. Now, I'm going to switch this up completely now. I'm going to tell you, I've started doing something tennis related and I want your opinion on it. I think I know the answer, unfortunately. So I was a not terrible tennis player as a youth. Like I was on the edge of the county team. I played at university.
Oh, that's pretty good.
I mean, it's, you know, it's not your level, but it's, you know, I can hit a ball. And I, you know, I kept playing and I played in tournaments at clubs through the years and so on. And then I didn't play during the pandemic, although you could. Actually, tennis was one of the sports relatively early on. Tennis and golf seem to have had a good pandemic.
My career choice and being like, oh my gosh, I need to like be an essential worker. This is, and then all of a sudden, I'm an essential worker because sport is healthy for the mentality, right? And your mental wealth and health. And tennis is a social distancing sport. So I was celebrating, two arms up in the air. I'm an essential worker. Who knew?
No, but like, you know, the coaching you will have done for people will have been like the only time they can leave the house and do something with another person. Like,
yeah,
you can see how it makes a difference. But the guy I play with the most went to Hawaii for a year because he's a writer, couldn't get any work. Family are from Hawaii, so they just went. So I didn't have anyone to play with. And he came back about 10 days ago and he's like, right, let's go down to the tennis club, which we're members of, and let's play pickleball. Because I think he'd been playing it with his parents and we played it. And I think pickleball's meant to be for septuagenarians, but it was an enormous amount of fun. And we played the other day, in the deciding game, we were playing first in 11 and it went to like 18-16 because it's got win by two. It was an amazing game. And we were discussing afterwards how we wondered if we're ever going to play tennis again now because we've sort of forgotten how to play long form and we're old and, you know, our bodies hurt now. At what age should you give up tennis and start playing pickleball? Am I doing this too early in your professional
opinion? Here's my question. You said you think you know the answer. What do you think the answer is going to be out of curiosity?
Well, the other people on the neighbouring courts were not younger than us. So I felt
you were asking because it's funny, as soon as you say the P word to some tennis people, now that's what, and this isn't my stance, but there is a lot of friction between tennis clubs and the tennis coaches and everything else. I mean, you say pickleball to one of my ex-colleagues, a director I worked for, and yeah, he will banish you. He hates it.
What is it, because it's taking up court space that could be used, or it's not real?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, and I understand that. If your club is here's my stance on it. I have played it a couple of times now. I love it. I'm actually thinking about trying to go pro in it because it's the fastest growing sport and there's really good money in it. Yeah. And I'm really damn good at it because I'm crafty as can be as far as my game was in tennis. I was a crafty junkie. Like Judy was smart with Andy. She taught us variety. So I people are surprised when they play with me. I've always been a believer. If I were running a club, I think they can both live harmoniously. I think if you have the court space anyway, a lot of the time, like you've just said, when do you give up tennis? Look, there's no need to pick. You can do both. If you're feeling tired or whatever, of course, pickleball is a little bit easier physically. But I also think that craft can kind of help the tennis game. I think both, if you're smart, you can run both programs at a club and not lose anyone. I think when they start pitting, like if a director really doesn't want pickleball, it's going to force your players who want to do pickleball to go elsewhere. And same thing goes for tennis. If you don't accept pickleball you accept pickleball and you see that as your growth and you don't keep tennis, you're going to lose your tennis players. But so I think it's smart if you can try and introduce both to each other. But no, pickleball is the fastest growing sport right now. And I know a lot of young people playing in it. I know a lot of ex-tennis players and ex-tennis pros starting to take it up. I was meant to play last Wednesday, actually, all night with a bunch of seasoned players. I ended up not being able to, sadly, but I also have another friend who used to be a rep for Babolat, and then he was a college coach, an assistant coach for two very prestigious schools, and he's now giving lessons at the Riviera Club down by your end in your way, and is basically trying to be pro in that. And he's actually who I wrote to, and I said, hey, can I come down and play with you guys one day? Because I want to see what it takes and if I actually could go pro in it. Because, yeah, I'd consider it. I like the sport. I think it's great. I don't think there should be an age limit on it.
Because when he asked me to play, I didn't even know what it was. So I Googled it and I started watching some tournament in Vegas. And it was young people being very enthusiastic and diving all over the place. And there was prize money. And I'm like, oh, this looks like fun.
ESPN.
Is it?
Yeah. Indian Wells. There's a massive, they have so many courts. It is massive. And so, there's good money in it, if you're good, of course. But that's why I figure if I get in now, before it grows too big.
I might. Yeah, I mean, it's very accessible. Like we play, we have very long rallies. Like we used to have good tennis games, but you've only got an hour. You go down. The bat was racket, whatever it is, was $15. I think it was. Like it was
a very paddle.
Sorry, yes.
And that's the thing. It's just like tennis rackets. You can go down to Walmart, get your $10 racket, or you can pay $250. I've looked at the Wilson pickleball bats because that's who I'm with, Wilson. And I almost wrote to my rep and said, hey, I want a pickleball thing. Because I looked at the price. I mean, they can get expensive too, let me tell you.
Why is it so popular? Is it just because people got short attention span and they like small sports nowadays?
No, I honestly, truthfully, you think about tennis. You know, it's funny you saying you're decent. I know you're decent. Not to bash Americans. You know, I've lived here longer now than Scotland. I'm still obviously very Scottish. I'm going to take that to the grave with me. But I definitely have, you know, a lot of my friends say I'm very American, so I'm not bashing on them. But as a coach, when I get an American tennis player, it was hard for me to come to terms to in the beginning. And now it doesn't even, if you say this to me, it kind of goes over my head because it doesn't mean anything. But when I first coached over here and someone came to me, I'd say, hey, what's your experience? And they said, oh, yeah, you know, I played in high school. I'm thinking, okay, great. And then would start playing and I'm like, wait, what? Like, they can't hit the ball. They're terrible. And I was like, how on earth were you on your, and I obviously I'm not saying this to them, but I'm thinking, how on earth were you on a team? You cannot hit a ball. Because in Britain, and I think it's because our PE was different, right? And we're playing, you know, rounders and our hand-eye coordination. We're playing all those games. So you think about, and I think we take it for granted, because even when I worked out in the Hamptons every summer, I had a British guy come to me. He's like, oh, I'm terrible. I'm like a newbie. I've never played before. And here he is, never played, and I've got these Americans taking lesson after lesson after lesson. He was way better than them. And I was like, I knew you'd be able to play. You're English. Like, I knew it. Same when I get an Indian player that's played cricket, I'm like, you're going to be fine. Got it. So you think about it. You've played tennis, but think about if you, when you first started, how easy was it to have a rally over that big net and the big court with the, right? It is a very skillful sport. Whereas pickleball, I wouldn't put money on it because I don't know yet. But if I were to teach it, I think I could confidently say that after an hour, you would be able to have a rally with someone. Tennis, not the case.
Yeah.
True. So I think that's why, is because it's easier to pick up. I mean, you're going to lose interest if you're not able to have a rally. It's no fun running after balls all the time. Whereas pickleball, you could have someone who really doesn't have as much hand-eye coordination, no matter the level, you would be able to have a rally with them at the end of an hour. So I think it's just, it's that. It's also for the age of people too. Like, you know, we're learning more in the like exercise science and physical side of things, of bashing the joints and everything else. Yeah, tennis is tough. And a full court, like that's why doubles is the main club sport, is because it's less movement. So that's why I think pickleball is the go-to for the older generation, because they can play for hours and hours. Although ironically, they ended up getting injured because they played for hours and hours and they weren't used to it. And then I think for the younger generation is it's easier to pick up. I mean, it's fun if you can actually play. And tennis, I hate to say it, no matter how good the coach, it can sometimes be tough to play after even hours of lessons.
Yeah. Fantastic.
So look, I need to get you on the pickleball court now.
I was going to say, so I was about to ask the last question, but I'm going to ask the penultimate question, which, can we play pickleball together?
Absolutely. If you're okay with getting beat. like I just said, any level can play with any level. I know we'll be able to rally. But... No,
look, I mean, I get a little bit annoyed when I lose to my slightly overweight Hawaiian friend. but if I play pickleball with the former world tennis number 167 who's played at two Wimbledons and I get beaten, and you're younger than me, I'm comfortable with that. But I like the idea, you know.
That's how the first people I ever played with in San Diego felt. I actually was playing with a friend and he's like, hey, it was actually a guy that he sponsored me for my last few months on tour. And I went to visit him to, you know, as kind of a gratitude visit again, not forgetting what he did for me. And so I was like, all right, you want to go play tennis? And he goes, how about pickleball? And I was like, I've never played it before, but let's do it. So we're playing, and then two locals saw us playing and asked, could they play? And he's, you know, telling them, you know, it's my first time. And so at first they're a little butthurt that they're losing. And then finally he fessed up and he's like, look, don't be too upset. She was a world tennis player after all. And they were like, ah, could have told us.
Fantastic.
Bringing in the ringer.
Maybe you can come to my club and you can casually come and join my team. We can ringer. Play doubles, and then I'll tell them afterwards who you really are.
Ringer, yeah.
Very good. So look, last question. We ask every guest, if you could drink any whiskey with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, what would it be, and where would it be?
I thought about this too after hearing your podcasts, and it's so tough. I hope it's not too cheesy and too like obvious. I mean, being Scottish, okay, obviously has to be someone Scottish. There's been times I've gone back and forth and thought of like Celtic players and everything else, but I think the biggest for me would be to go back in time and have one with either William Wallace, right, or Robert the Bruce. Just, I've always said it. I wish there was, and I hope someone can steal my idea, but let me in on the if you end up making it big. I like the idea of, and I know they do like medieval dinners, right? You go in a dinner and you see a medieval play. I think it'd be absolutely fascinating if someone somewhere was able to have a time experience where you go back and you can live a day in the each like century or each, you know, age as a poor person and as a rich person and kind of experience it. And that's one thing. And I've always been fascinated with history. And so of course, Scottish history is the biggest one. I would have many questions, but I think it would probably William Wallace first. And then, yeah, and if not, I mean, Robert the Bruce. If I could talk with them both, that'd be fantastic.
So it's interesting, actually, 73 episodes into this podcast, probably half of them with Scottish people. Nobody's gone. The nearest we've got to that answer was one of the people on the podcast was a child actor in Braveheart. but that wasn't what he chose. Great answer. Now, where and which whiskey?
Oh, where and which whiskey? So where... Naturally, I would have to say, I mean, the crappy part of me says Stirling Bridge. Do you know why?
Stirling Bridge. As in Stirling Bridge, where William Wallace he was from Stirling. So,
yeah. So that there, and also, wasn't it the Battle of Stirling Bridge, where we actually ended up defeating you guys because we outsmarted you.
I don't know my Scottish history as well as I should.
And that's why I would like to go back, is because, yeah, I mean, I need a refresher too, for sure. But where it kind of all began. It would need to be in Scotland, or I would say up in the Highlands where he was hiding. Very, you know, scenic, quiet. I think that would be, and I just think the Scottish Highlands are gorgeous, beautiful, especially on a sunny day, which is rare. And then which whiskey? Well, as long as it was Scottish, I really wouldn't care.
Come on, you can be more specific than that.
Lefroy, then. An old Lefroy, because we'd be in the Highlands in I was saying pre-match, I'm getting into the smoky ones more. So I would, and if anyone else has another one to recommend, an older, smokier one, maybe even, didn't you just say the one you're having is a little bit smoky?
A little bit. It's not very smoky compared to others.
I'm sure I could find a better answer. If I look through history, I would probably look at dates and stuff and try and figure out a whiskey that kind of ties into the history of either William Wallace and either like a battle or a year. I'd probably end up doing that to mark the occasion.
Very good. They can take away our lives, but they can't take away our whiskey.
There you go. Oh, I like it. That's brilliant. You just come up with that.
Very good. Look, this has been brilliant. Nicola Slater, soon to be the last person to beat me at pickleball. Thank you very much for being part of the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad we finally got this done. And I'm not on a health kick. I'm finally back to having a few sips.
And, you know, thank you to the probably the least organized pilot who works for Delta, who didn't know that it might snow in Utah in January and made our flight late, and we wouldn't have met otherwise. So
last international trip I made, that was, to tell you what.
Was it March then, that trip?
That was February. It was mid-February. I got back January. January 29th was my flight back. And then, February, and then the pandemic hit.
Yeah, it might be. I think I went again in March. I think it was my penultimate trip. But still, yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll be meeting any Scottish tennis players in airports anytime soon, but you never know.
No, I don't think so. Hopefully. I mean, I hope so. That's what Judy's doing. She's doing her best, growing the game more and more over there. But yeah, fingers crossed we have someone after the Murrays.
Absolutely. Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed. This has been brilliant. Thanks, Nicola.
Thanks, Dan. Thank you.
I love Scotch. Scotch. Scotch.
And don't forget to not just follow us on Twitter and Instagram at US of Dramerica, but also ask us questions and comment and say nice things.
And please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if the mood takes you, you can leave us a review, as feedback is always welcome.
And drink whiskey. Sláinte.